Hola, soy Daniel Jadue.
I am Daniel Jadue, a citizen of Chile, originally from Palestine, born like so many other Palestinians around the world in the diaspora. Chile has one of the largest communities outside the Arab world. It is said that we are close to 300,000, but we are millions spread across the face of the earth, far from our homeland, but committed to the identity, history and struggle of our people, of our land, which is and will forever be Palestine.
Hola a todos y a todas. Marhaba.
Hello everyone, marhaba. The Palestinians do not own Palestine. They have belonged to that land for thousands of years. They have been there since before the first invader arrived, and they will surely be there in the same place when the last one leaves. In more than 3,000 years of history, there have only been about 200 years of true peace in Palestine. And Palestine, because of its geopolitical and geostrategical significance, has always been the center of a dispute for world hegemonies. This land creates connections between Africa, Asia, and Europe.
Al ser el punto de contacto entre África, Asia y Europa.
The terrorism that Palestine suffers today is undoubtedly endorsed by the international community, which has completely failed in the objectives of maintaining peace and avoiding a new genocide.
Como dice el secretario general.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations says, what is happening today in Palestine is unprecedented, not only during his mandate, but throughout the entire history of the UN. The international community has completely failed, and international law, both human rights and international humanitarian law, have simply become a resounding ridicule in the face of the thousands of lives that are being slaughtered today. They are facing genocide by Israel's policy of political and physical extermination of the Palestinian people. Let's take a look at this report by journalist Huda Eghazi, who will give us more information about this absolute failure of the international community.
Acerca de este absoluto fracaso de la comunidad internacional.
The UN General Assembly has called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Palestinian territory of the Gaza Strip. The gesture takes place while, due to the United States veto, the Security Council has not adopted any resolution in favor of truce. The text of the General Assembly resolution has enjoyed the support of the overwhelming majority of the international community.
The United States is deciding the course of the lives of all Gazans when it uses its veto power. Therefore, it is complicit in the crimes that Israel is committing against the people of the Gaza Strip, using the veto to reject the call for a ceasefire, which is asked by almost all of the world countries, means condemning an entire people in general.
Despite the ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people that began on October 7, 2023, and the murder of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, the Security Council has failed to adopt a resolution calling for a ceasefire. Many countries and human rights organizations have lamented the failure of this entity.
All decisions that have been made by the UN Security Council and the United Nations are under the direct influence of the United States, since Washington has the final say. No one can make any decision without being approved by the United States, since it controls the entity. Many states in the international community support Israel, except for a few like the Islamic Republic of Iran, Venezuela, and etc. But in general, many states, including Arab ones, support Israel. The Arab states of the Persian Gulf also support Israel.
It seems that Israel is not satisfied with the demolition of Gaza homes, infrastructure, and killing of civilians. Images have recently emerged of Palestinians being detained by the occupation army, being forced to strip to their underwear, kneeling on the ground, blindfolded, and held in inhumane conditions. These images have provoked outrage among civil society in different corners of the world.
The Israel army does not differentiate between children, civilians, and the elderly, especially in the northern area of Gaza. They enter any place they want and arrest whoever they want, even arresting children under 15 years of age without any fault, even committing violent acts against them. This is a criminal act. There is no country in the world that has done what the regime of Israel has committed. Look what happened between Russia and Ukraine. Everyone came out in protest to stop the war. The war that Israel is waging against Gaza is more criminal than what the Nazis did in Germany. What Israel does is a crime, and it is not justifiable.
It no es justificable.
The Hamas resistance movement accused Israel in a statement of kidnapping and murdering innocent civilians, describing it as a reprehensible crime, and insisted on human rights organizations to intervene. Despite all the crimes that Israel is committing against the civilian population in the Gaza Strip, the international community, especially the West, continues to fail to react to this ongoing genocide. This shows how the United States, the main sponsor of Tel Aviv, has become complicit in atrocities against the nation. Hoda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
Sin duda que las víctimas del Holocausto nazi.
No doubt the victim of the Nazi Holocaust would roll in their graves if they could see what their descendants are capable of doing to the Palestinian people today. We thank Huda for this interesting report and greet Jorge Ramos Tolosa, PhD in history, a professor specialized in the contemporary and recent history of Palestine at the University of Germany. Thank you, Jorge, for being with us. A hug and welcome. I want to ask you two questions that everyone should be asking. Zionism has said time and again that Palestine belongs to them. You could first tell us who lived in Palestine before the creation of the regime of Israel and what role the Western powers played in the creation of Israel.
En la creación del Estado de Israel en la tierra de los palestinos?
Sí, claro. Bueno, lo primero, muchísimas gracias por invitarme.
Yes, of course. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me. It is a pleasure to be here with you. I think it is a fundamental question, Daniel, to address any issue related to Palestine. I think it is essential to understand that for more than a millennium, for more than 1,000 years, Palestine has been a very diverse territory in which Jewish people, Christian people, Muslim people, people from other minorities of any kind have lived following their own religions. And it all begins not 2,000 years ago. The question of Palestine does not go back to 2,000 years. It is not a religious issue, although we are talking about the Holy Land, obviously, and there are different actors who use religion as a legitimizing element and as a mobilizing element. And Zionism itself, although in the beginning the majority of Zionists did not believe in God, and yet they did believe that God has given them the earth. So this is essential. We're talking about a colonial issue, specifically settler colonialism that began at the end of the 19th century when this Zionist movement, which did not represent Judaism, nor was it a branch of Judaism. Neither Zionism nor the regime of Israel represent Judaism, nor are they branches of Judaism, but they do speak in its name. But it has precisely become a Zionist movement. And if we review contemporary Jewish history, we see that there have been and currently exist numerous people and numerous Jewish groups that are clearly anti-Zionist, both from religious Jewish identities and from cultural Jewish identities or by family heritage. So of course in Palestine, as they say, when Zionism emerged at the end of the 19th century, there were no problems between the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim communities. By the way, they all spoke Arabic. They were all Arabs. It is a criterion above all linguistic cultural criteria. And they lived together in a territory that belonged to the Ottoman Empire. And of course, it was the arrival of a European settlement colonialism movement that drew on European Judeophobic racism and that basically accepted the racist anti-Jewish idea that Jewish people could not live in Europe, which triggered the colonialization of Palestine. The problems created by these hegemonies we are seeing to this day. And of course, this Zionist movement had at its center and continues to have at its center the regime of Israel, obtaining the maximum possible territory with a minimum native population, with a minimum non-Jewish population. So, of course, how to achieve this? This is a question. At the end of the 19th century, there were 85 to 86% of the Palestinian population that was Muslim. 10 to 11% of the population that was Christian and less than 5% that were Jewish. Now, how can one accept that a territory with less than 5% Jewish demographic becomes exclusively or mostly Jewish, as Zionism intended? Of course, history is never written, nor is it linear, but obviously, this Zionist objective could hardly be achieved without massively expelling or discriminating and segregating the native Palestinian population. We call this apartheid. Then in 1948, the regime of Israel was created. The Zionist movement had a fundamental triumph, but its objective of expanding over the maximum possible territory with the minimum Palestinian population did not end there. But 75 years later, it is still continues and it is still underway.
We're going to have the audience ask you two questions so that we can also answer the doubts they have. Who would like to ask Jorge? Please.
Hola. Mi nombre es Dante Olate.
Hello, my name is Dante Olate. I'm a student, and I wanted to ask what the Sykes-Picot Agreement is, what this treaty consists of, and how it affected the fate of Palestine.
¿Y cómo afectó el destino de Palestina?
Muy bien, muchas gracias por tu pregunta, Dante.
Very good. Thank you very much for your question, Dante. Of course, it is essential to understand that the Zionist movement began the colonization of Palestine at the end of the 19th century when Palestine was an undifferentiated entity that was part of the Ottoman Sultanate. And one of its main purposes was to gain the support of a great power, because, of course, it was a movement of settler colonialism. The Zionist movement was not directed solely by a state, nor was it a company of a state, as was the case with the British East India Company or the Dutch. So it was essential to get the support of a great power. So in the context of the First World War, where the Sykes-Picot Agreement that you mentioned happened, we must take into account that the United Kingdom was the most important imperial power of the time. Following the outbreak of the First World War, one of its enemies was the Ottoman Sultanate. With regard to the strategic position that Palestine had in the Eastern Mediterranean, almost at a crossroads between Africa, Asia, and Europe, it could be the ideal place for creating an ally for future, a puppet state, or a geopolitical platform that served their interests or was linked to their interests. Then, of course, here also the second great imperial power of the time, which was France, was interested in the fact that if the Ottoman Sultanate was defeated, it could gain some profits from the remains of the numerous territories of the Ottoman Sultanate. France and the United Kingdom were seeking territorial advantages and acquiring those territories, and in fact, they were thinking how to manage to colonize those territories after the Ottoman Sultanate was defeated. And so it happened. Secretly, in the spring of 1916, Mark Sykes and Francois Georges Picot, British and French delegates respectively, signed secret agreements, the Sykes-Picot Agreements, by which they divided a large part of the territory of the Ottoman Sultanate, and it finally happened. In case the Ottoman Sultanate lost the First World War, the disintegration and end of this empire was forced. So it is essential to understand that these agreements, which were, by the way, revealed by the Bolshevik revolutionary forces in November 1917, a little more than a year after their signing and a few weeks after the revolution of October 1917, of course, these agreements were fundamental for future. The distribution of the map of the Eastern Mediterranean of Southwest Asia, this is essential. And furthermore, they were hand-in-hand with the famous Balfour Declaration. In the Balfour Declaration of November 1917, what Zionism had been seeking for long happened for the first time. For the first time, the United Kingdom stated in a letter that it was going to support the creation of a Jewish national home, which everyone understood to be a state that the Zionist movement sought. And then, although there were ambiguous and ambivalent formulas, effectively, this declaration came while the British troops arrived in Palestine and stayed there with the aim of incorporating Palestine into the British Empire in the following years. The British forces, which were in Palestine since 1917, after the British Mandate of Palestine became effective, they abandoned Palestine in 1948, and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the creation of the State of Israel began. At this time, the United Kingdom fully supported the Zionist movement. And in fact, we still see many borders in the Eastern Mediterranean and Southwest Asia that correspond to this era, right? The United Kingdom was left with the administration of Palestine and Jordan, Iraq and France, with Syria and Lebanon, and they were British and French colonies, respectively, for several decades until they achieved their independence. But the case of Palestine is special. It has been different and continues to be different precisely because of this movement of colonialism. The United Kingdom was the only settlement that was already there from previous decades, which was Zionism and achieved the creation of the regime of Israel through ethnic cleansing in 1948. A través de la limpieza étnica en 1948.
Muchas gracias, Jorge, por...
Thank you very much, Jorge, for your presence on our program. I give you a hug from here, and I hope to be able to contact you again in the future. Thank you so much.
De aquí en el futuro. Muchas gracias.
Also a pleasure. Thank you very much to you.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back.
Bueno, ya estamos de vuelta, y queremos hablar...
Well, we are back, and we want to talk about another one of the main victims of this historic Palestinian aggression. We're going to talk about culture, and for that, we have invited Andrea Giadach, Chilean actress, playwright, theater director of Palestinian origin, but also someone who has worked for a long time in the field of culture, fundamentally rescuing traditions, reconstructing her own identity.
Andrea Giadach is a playwright, director, actress, and member of the Artists for Palestine NGO. Her works are recognized everywhere and among her peers. She has worked on topics such as the loss of the homeland, identity, and reconstruction, among others. As the granddaughter of Palestinian migrants, her story and her vocation have been crossed by the diaspora and by the link with artistic communities in the occupied territories of Palestine. One of her most notable works is Mi Mundo Patria, which is scenic heritage. Together with Alejandra Diaz, an actress of Jewish origin, they founded the Natuf Collective, made of Chileans of Palestine and Jewish origin, and whose main work is El Circulo, which seeks to remove views regarding antagonists and the possibility of relating honestly without denialism and trying to see the other reality.
Hi, Andrea. How are you? Thank you very much for coming and for accepting this invitation. I always start by asking, when and why did your family arrive in Chile?
Well, thanks, Daniel, for the invitation. Indeed, my family arrived at the beginning of the 20th century because of the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, who were in the entire Levant area as well. We were in Palestine when Palestine was still Palestine, because there was a multicultural space there. They took the Christians as soldiers and used them as cannon fodder. So many Palestinians at that time came to Chile and formed a large community, among them my grandfather. That's how they arrived here, more or less. I could go on, but we can talk about so many things today.
No, está muy bien. Bueno, esto se da efectivamente...
Oh, no, it's okay. Well, this actually was because of a change that occurred in 1898 on the part of the Turkish Sultan, because with the emergence of national states and the loss of the religious character of the Empire of States, the prohibition on both Jews and Christians was lifted to participate in the war defending the empire against the West. And when this happens, they actually begin to take everyone to the army, especially the firstborn, Jews and Christians, and that is why there was a very strong immigration from this entire area, and that defines their diaspora in Chile and throughout the world of a great Christian community. In Latin America, the countries that have this Christian community are fundamentally Honduras, El Salvador, and Chile, which is where the Palestinians of that group have settled. Now, you are third generation, aren't you?
Tú eres entonces tercera generación.
Yes, I am the third generation.
Did your parents always raise you as a Palestinian?
¿Cómo Palestina?
Mi padre
Sobre todo, me crió como
Palestinian. My father, above all, raised me as a Palestinian, but more than as a Palestinian, under the consciousness of a Palestinian-ness. And I also believe that he is to blame for me being a Palestinian activist, because I am not aware of when I started to become active, given my father always taught me about and showed me Zionist and anti-Arab propaganda. Since I was little, he showed me the movies, how the Arabs were portrayed as the bad guys among other people, among the Russians, etc. But well, he always made me very alert in relation to media propaganda and how the media continues to this day, right? We can see it. They are absolutely taken over by Zionism.
Hasta el día de hoy, ¿verdad? Lo podemos ver, están tomados absolutamente por el sionismo.
A ver, yo tengo un poco una respuesta.
Let's see. I kind of have an answer that you just said you don't have. I'll try it. Because you say, I don't really know when I became an activist, and I feel that you become an activist when you find your place in the world. You found your place in the world of theater, in the world of theatrical creation, true? And I remember since we knew each other, which are many more years than we would like to admit to, right? From your first steps after leaving theater school, you started creating theater around Palestine. I remember very well the first work I saw of your own creation. It was Mi Mundo Patria, right? Which told the story of Fadda Wabe, a Palestinian immigrant, and from then on, I remind you, always linked to theatrical creation around Palestine first, and around the recovery of peaceful coexistence later. Tell us a little bit about that.
Cuéntanos un poco de aquello.
Sí, bueno, efectivamente, Mi Mundo Patria...
Yes, well, indeed, Mi Mundo Patria, my homeland, as you say, makes me an activist. But Mi Mundo Patria also makes me a director and playwright. And that is because of a deep need that Lorena Ramirez Alamo had. She was my partner with whom we made this creation. And of course, my own need, a common need, to make known the reality of Palestine. Since I was little, since I was in school, I talked about Palestine, and they seemed to look at you as if you're against the Jews and poor Jews who were in the Holocaust. That was the story only. I say, well, how should we talk about Palestine in a way that we can really attract people? So what I did was take certain relevant episodes, which is the loss of homeland and childhood in three people of different nationalities, origins, or identities. And among those people was Fouad Dawawi. I took testimony, Dramaturgy Network, and that is the result of my homeland, which was incredible. It took place for years, and it is scenic heritage today.
We're still giving it. In fact, we saw it recently, right?
Yes, yes. And then I take on the challenge of creating a work from the antagonistic look. What's that? We met Chilean Jews and Palestinians. I proposed to them, well, the only thing I can propose here is that we go as far as we can. And I invite you to generate or establish a dialogue to see how far we can turn our look. We can see others in that way. We're always talking about hegemonic stories and other stories, macro stories, right? But we had micro stories based on a question, which was, to what extent do we generate otherness for fear of rejection from the community itself? The result was incredible. We presented this worm for many times, and recently we had a roaming, a circulation in three regions of Chile in the south. And not only were the Jews and the Palestinians affected by this worm, but many Chilean people said, this work is very necessary because we are increasingly polarized. Of course, the Palestinian reality is so absolute that it always goes on. And if there is someone who dares to look, there is no turning back.
Andrea, I want to thank you for this interesting interview. And of course, we are going to continue seeing each other. And I will undoubtedly be in this new work that you are preparing. Thank you so much.
Sin duda, en esta nueva obra que están preparando ustedes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. See you in the next chapter.
Muchas gracias. Nos vemos en el próximo capítulo.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has suffered a number of defeats in the House of Lords over his controversial bill to rescue the stalled Rwanda plan. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Civil servants have threatened ministers with legal action over concerns that senior Home Office staff could be in breach of international law if they implement the government's Rwanda deportation bill. The FDA union, which represents senior civil servants, have warned that they could also be in violation of the Civil Service Code and open to possible prosecution if they follow the minister's demands to ignore an urgent injunction from Strasbourg banning a deportation. It has sent a pre-action legal letter to James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, calling for clarity, with a request to either amend the legislation or change the code. The Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill states that it is for ministers to decide whether to comply with decisions by the European Court of Human Rights to temporarily halt a deportation. The letter said, "The concern of the FDA union and many of its members is that if ministers instruct civil servants not to comply with an interim measure indication, they will be putting the United Kingdom in breach of international law." With the bill due to return to the House of Commons in the coming days and the government expected to try to get the first flights off the ground within days of that, the FDA union warned that it may require legal proceedings to clarify the matter. People who have been refused asylum could reportedly be offered thousands of pounds to move to Rwanda under a new voluntary scheme. According to the Times newspaper, the proposals, which are separate from the main scheme and are understood to have been agreed with Kigali, are designed to remove people who have no legal right to stay in the United Kingdom but cannot be returned to their home country. It will be aimed at individuals who do not have an outstanding asylum claim and are in a position to be relocated swiftly. An intervention by a Strasbourg judge last June stopped the only attempted deportation flight from taking off for Rwanda. Dave Penman, the FDA's general secretary, said in his letter that the government had acknowledged there was a problem and planned to issue draft guidance to make it clear that it was the responsibility of civil servants to implement the decisions of ministers. Sir Matthew Ryecroft, the Home Office's top civil servant, said in a letter dated 17th of January, "Given the nature of removal flights, officials should be available to advise ministers at short notice and during the evenings and weekends. Home Office officials shall proceed with removal if the relevant minister approves that course of action." But Dave Penman said that while the FDA union welcomed the government's recognition of the need to clarify civil servants' responsibilities, it did not consider the guidance to be adequate. He cited advice from the Attorney General, revealed recently that it was beyond doubt that interim measures from the court to stop a deportation were binding for the United Kingdom under international law, and that there was no respectable argument to the contrary. The letter goes on to say that difficulty arises because civil servants have personal legal obligations under domestic law not to act contrary to international law. That obligation is not capable of being overwritten by any ministerial instruction or guidance. The Civil Service Code states that officials must comply with the law, which the government has previously confirmed includes international law, meaning that any ministerial instruction to ignore a Strasbourg ruling would be a breach of their terms of service. The letter adds, ministers do not employ civil servants and cannot unilaterally change or alter their terms of service. The guidance is erroneous in law and gives serious uncertainty for civil servants and would foreseeably place them in an exceptionally difficult position. The FDA union warned that given the implementation of new Rwanda bill in coming weeks, its letter was acting as a pre-action notification of a potential claim for judicial review in the event of ministers instructing officials to ignore a Strasbourg injunction. A government spokesperson said matters of international law are rightly a matter for ministers in the event that the ministers decides, in the light of full policy, operational and legal advice, not to comply with a Rule 39 indication in an individual case, it is the responsibility of civil servants operating under the Civil Service Code to implement that decision. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has suffered a number of defeats in the House of Lords over his controversial bill to rescue the stalled Rwanda plan. House of Lords peers have voted through five amendments which, if enacted in law, would make it harder for Parliament to declare the African nation safe and would require the government to comply with domestic and international laws. This would effectively kill the central purpose of the legislation, which aims to prevent further legal challenges against the policy after it was ruled unlawful by Britain's Supreme Court. The votes don't scupper the bill entirely, but set into motion the process of parliamentary ping-pong between the House of Lords and the House of Commons until an agreement is reached. As well as compelling judges to regard Rwanda as safe, Rishi Sunak's Safety of Rwanda Bill is designed to give ministers the power to disregard key sections of the UK's Human Rights Act and other international rules that stand in the way of deportations. Peers from across the political spectrum have criticised it because they believe it breaks international law. On Monday, 4th of March, the upper chamber backed a move to ensure the legislation is fully compliant with the law by 274 votes to 172, a majority of 102. The House of Lords also backed by 282 to 180, another majority of 102, a demand that Parliament cannot declare Rwanda safe until the treaty it signed with the country in December is fully implemented. The treaty aims to address the issues raised by the Supreme Court in November and includes provisions to stop asylum seekers who end up in Rwanda being sent back to their country of origin. In a third defeat for the government, peers voted by 277 votes to 167, a majority of 110, in favour of establishing a monitoring mechanism able to check whether Rwanda is safe. Two other amendments were passed which called for the presumption that Rwanda is safe to be open to challenge in the courts of law if credible evidence emerges. Lord Anderson of Ipswich, an independent crossbencher and lawyer, said, "If Rwanda is safe, as the government would have us believe, it has nothing to fear from such scrutiny." Several Conservative peers also voted against the government's position, including former Tory Chancellor Kenneth Clark. Ken Clark warned that if the bill is ultimately passed by Parliament, it will likely face another challenge in the Supreme Court.
ربنا ربنا Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very important question, and that question is concerned with the blessed month that we are currently in. In other words, the month of Ramadan. As you know, the month of Ramadan has commenced. We are in its beginning. And here at IRIB English Radio and The Key, we would like to offer our esteemed listeners a hearty congratulations on this most auspicious month. As you know, the month of Ramadan is one of the most important, or rather the most important month in the Islamic calendar. In fact, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, at the end of Sha'ban, when there were only 3 days left till the month of Ramadan, he told his companion Bilal, call all the people. So the people gathered together, and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam mounted the pulpit, praised Allah and glorified him, then continued, O people, this month that is coming upon you is the chief of all months. One particular night in it is better than 1,000 months. So this hadith, it tells us that the month of Ramadan is the best of months. The question we want to ask today is this: why is this month so special? Why is it so significant? In some of our previous sessions, we looked at a couple of ways in which why this month is so significant. The first was that this is the month in which the Holy Quran was revealed as a whole upon the heart of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. And you know, the Quran is guidance for mankind. It guides human beings to that which is better for them in this world and in the hereafter. This is one of the significances of this month. Another is that this is the month in which fasting, Soam has been made obligatory upon all of us. This is another important part of Ramadan. And the last aspect of Ramadan that we mentioned was very made it very significant, was the fact that in the month of Ramadan, the chances of one's repentance being accepted are very high. We want to elaborate on this a little bit further. It's been narrated from Imam Ali alayhi salam that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam addressed us one day saying, O people, verily the month of God has come to you with benediction, mercy, and forgiveness. A month that is the best of months in the sight of God, whose days are the best of days, whose nights are the best of nights, and whose hours are the best of hours. It is the month wherein you have been invited to a banquet of God and have been made worthy of Allah's magnanimity. Your breaths during this month are considered glorification of God, and your sleep worship. Your actions in it are accepted, and your supplications answered. Upon hearing this, I stood up, meaning Imam Ali stood up, and asked, O Prophet of God, what is the best of deeds to be performed in this month? Now, we'll leave that for later on. In some of our forthcoming sessions, we might analyze that. But as you can see, in this month, God Almighty has promised us forgiveness if we ask Him for it. And this is what makes this month so very important and so very significant. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the reasons for the significance of the month of Ramadan in the light of the Quran and Hadith. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy in the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the United States, former Vice President Mike Pence has said he cannot in good conscience endorse former President Donald Trump for president in 2024. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. Former Vice President Mike Pence said on Friday, 15th of March, he will not be endorsing his former boss, Donald Trump, in the 2024 general election. Appearing on Fox News Channel, Mike Pence said he cannot in good conscience back Trump as there are profound differences between their views on various issues. Mike Pence, who unsuccessfully ran for the Republican nomination, declined to reveal who he plans to vote for in November, but he said he would never vote for President Joe Biden. It should come as no surprise that I will not be endorsing Donald Trump this year, Pence said after being asked by Fox News host Martha McCallum. Pence slammed Donald Trump for pursuing an agenda that is at odds with the conservative agenda the two abided by during their administration. Mike Pence added, "Look, I'm incredibly proud of the record of our administration. It was a conservative record that made America more prosperous, more secure, and saw conservatives appointed to our courts in a more peaceful world. That being said, during my presidential campaign, I made it clear there were profound differences between me and President Trump on a range of issues, not just our difference on my constitutional duties that I exercised on 6th of January 2021. Mike Pence said Donald Trump's stance on the national deficit, his position on abortion, and most recently his reversal on TikTok ban are among his reasons for not endorsing his former running mate, in addition to what unfolded on 6th of January 2021. Trump's pressure on Mike Pence to reject the 2020 election results, which Pence said endangered his family's life on 6th of January 2021, prompted a rift in their relationship and prompted Pence to argue on the campaign trail that his efforts to overturn his election loss should be disqualifying. Asked who he plans to vote for in the general election, Mike Pence said, "Like most Americans, I'm going to keep my vote to myself. I would never vote for Joe Biden, though," Pence said, when asked if he would vote for Biden. "How I vote when that curtain closes, that will be for me to decide." Mike Pence dismissed the idea of backing a third-party candidate or himself running as a third-party candidate, saying, "I'm a Republican." Later on, when asked if he'd run as a third-party candidate, Pence more clearly dismissed the idea, saying, "I'm a Republican." Pence acknowledged the fact that Republican primary voters have made their choice clear and said he plans to spend the rest of the year pushing for what we should be for. Republican primary voters have made it clear who they're for in this election, Pence said. What I'm going to spend the rest of the year is talking about what we should be for, the broad mainstream conservative agenda that has defined our party and always made America strong and prosperous and free. On the campaign trail, Mike Pence never directly ruled out voting for Trump in 2024, but repeatedly said, "I don't think I'll have to." He argued Republicans would select a new standard bearer before Trump this week secured enough delegates to presumptively be the GOP nominee. After warning against what he called the siren song of populism, Mike Pence's political advocacy organization, Advancing American Freedom, announced plans last month to invest $20 million in a program intended to uphold conservatism as bigger than any one moment, election, or person, in a not-so-thinly veiled swipe against his former boss, Donald Trump, and CPAC. The national broadcaster CBS News has also covered the same story. Former Vice President Mike Pence said on Friday, 15th of March, he cannot in good conscience endorse former President Donald Trump. "It should come as no surprise, I will not be endorsing Donald Trump this year," he said in an interview with Fox News. Mike Pence, who served as Trump's vice president, said the former president is pursuing and articulating an agenda that is at odds with the conservative agenda that we governed on during our 4 years in office. The former vice president's refusal to back Donald Trump is a reversal from earlier in the primary campaign when he raised his hand during the first Republican debate to say he would support Trump as the party's nominee even if he were to be convicted. Trump is now facing 4 separate indictments and is the first president ever to be accused of state and federal crimes. Mike Pence said on Friday, 15th of March, there were profound differences between him and Donald Trump on a number of issues, including his resistance against Trump's repeated demands to reject the Electoral College results after the 2020 election. "As I have watched his candidacy unfold, I've seen him walking away from our commitment to confronting the national debt," Mike Pence said. "I've seen him starting to shy away from a commitment to the sanctity of human life." Pence also criticized Donald Trump's opposition to legislation that would force Chinese company ByteDance to sell TikTok to continue operating in the United States. The former vice president wouldn't say who he's voting for next November, but also said it would not be President Joe Biden. Both Joe Biden and Donald Trump became the presumptive nominees of their respective parties earlier this week. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Mike Pence will not endorse for President Donald Trump, the man he served as vice president for 4 years, but whose supporters chanted for Pence to be hanged as they attacked Congress on 6th of January 2021. "It should come as no surprise that I will not be endorsing Donald Trump this year," the former Indiana governor and former candidate for the Republican presidential nomination told Fox News on Friday, 15th of March. Asked why, given that he previously promised to endorse the eventual GOP nominee, Mike Pence mentioned 6th of January 2021, the day a mob attacked Congress and Donald Trump was reported to have told aides that Pence deserved to be hanged for refusing to block certification of Joe Biden's election win. But Mike Pence placed more emphasis on policies pursued by Donald Trump as he has secured the Republican nomination a success achieved despite now facing 88 criminal charges under 4 indictments and suffering multi-million dollar civil penalties over his business affairs and a rape allegation a judge called substantially true. Mike Pence said he was incredibly proud of the record of our administration. It was a conservative record that made America more prosperous, more secure, and saw conservatives appointed to our courts of law. But he said, that being said, during my presidential campaign, which he ended last October, months before the first vote in Iowa, I made it clear that there were profound differences between me and President Trump on a range of issues, and not just our difference on my constitutional duties that I exercised on 6th of January 2021. As I have watched his candidacy unfold, I've seen him walking away from our commitment to confronting the national debt. I've seen him standing to shy away from a commitment to the sanctity of human life. The U.S. national debt ballooned under Donald Trump and Mike Pence. On abortion rights, the Supreme Court, to which Donald Trump appointed 3 right-wingers, did remove federal rights in 2022. But Republicans have since suffered a succession of election defeats as Democrats campaign on the issue.
On June 18, 1994, when Francisco Oscar Lamolina, the referee of the opening game of the World Cup, blew into the whistle, over 77,000 spectators were shouting in jeers at Pontiac Silverdome Stadium in Detroit. It was the first time that the World Cup was being held in the U.S. For a month, all eyes all over the world were fixated at the event. The shining stars of the world of football, like Romario, Roberto Baggio, Hristo Stoichkov, and Gheorghe Hagi, filled the stadiums to the brim. With every goal, yellow or red cards, the stadiums were in uproar, like the day when Nigeria thrashed Bulgaria with 3 goals and the fans of the team were madly shouting out of joy. People who had traveled thousands of miles from Africa so they could watch the games up close. Those days were good days for the people in Africa, but not for all the residents of the continent. Right at the time when people across the world were glued to their television sets to watch Nigeria's exhilarating display of skills, in a part of Africa, one of the most brutal genocide in the history of mankind was underway. Apparently, Rachel Carson is the biggest murderer in history, and yet nobody was aware for a long time. Everyone admired Carson for being a nice human being and a great author, and also for her role as an environmental activist. She has been praised in numerous books, articles, and reports, but in the end, the mask was removed from her face. They said that the woman who had a charming smile on her face in all of the pictures and the only thing she cared about was nature was behind the death of millions of people in Africa. The deaths happened after she genetically modified mosquitoes. If we take a look at history, we'll find out that Rachel Carson's life in many ways had striking similarity with major criminals throughout history, like Hitler, who used to paint pictures when he was a young man, or Stalin, who was a choir singer. Carson was into art, literature, and poetry. She was born in Pennsylvania and graduated from Johns Hopkins University in 1932. After getting a degree in zoology, she started her career as a journalist. 15 years later, she displayed so much talent and skills in the field of aquatic creatures that she supervised all publications in this field. During those years, she tried books besides working as a journalist. Her books are on environment and the seas, which gained Carson fame. She resigned from all of her posts in 1952, so she could concentrate mainly on writing books. The most important book she wrote in that period was her autobiography. The US media, as well as many chemists and physicians, say the book changed the fate of millions of people in African and many other parts of the world. Carson's name turned into the nightmare of people who were grappling with malaria.
In Africa and Asia, the mosquito is a mass killer. More than 2 million people die every year from malaria, which mosquitoes transmit.
Based on figures and documents proposed by Dr. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist at the University of San Jose in California, stated in his paper that the elimination of DDT helped the mosquitoes that transit malaria to reproduce without any barriers. In a few years, the population of the mosquitoes grew so large that millions of Africans fell victim to the disease and lost their lives, according to Edwards in an article titled Bias, Misinformation, Half-Truth, published in 1992 in the Science and Technology magazine. The Silent Spring has been one of the deadliest books in history as it sent millions of people in Africa to their death. Some people put the number of fatalities at about 50 million people, larger than the number of the casualties in the Second World War. The documents leaked in the 1980s and 1990s by some tobacco company staff revealed that the owners of the companies had known as an established fact from the 1950s that smoking can cause cancer. In one of these documents dated 1953, Claude Tigo, one of the scientific advisors of Camel Tobacco Company, wrote to his director that the tobacco in cigarettes is one of the main factors behind lung cancer, and added that there is a direct correlation between smoking and lung cancer. A decade before that, Emma Harris Palmer, the head of the research center of Lord Yard, acknowledged that there is ample evidence to prove the link between smoking and lung cancer.
The company is Brown & Williamson, America's third largest tobacco company. The man they've set out to destroy is Dr. Jeffrey Wigand, their former $300,000-a-year director of research.
In 1996, another revelation was made on CBS's 60 Minutes program. Jeffrey Wigand, one of the personnel of the Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company, leaked significant information about the tobacco industry. Michael Mann made a movie out of the developments named The Insider, starring Russell Crowe, who played the role of Jeffrey Wigand. The movie received accolade by film critics.
Catch you in a lie. They can paint everything with that brush. You understand?
Everything you say.
I told the truth.
Everything you say.
And I can't defend you, man, with one hand tied behind my back because you keep from me what they can discover.
And they will discover everything. Believe me.
I was young.
There are many documents like that. Yet, when the scientists were summoned to the U.S. Congress to testify about the addictive aspect of nicotine, they all testified that the substance is not addictive.